This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Governor Ron DeSantis is promising a bold vision for Florida. His first weeks in office have given hope to environmental advocates, school choice proponents, and supporters of medical marijuana. For analysis of just how bold that vision really is, we check in with political commentators Dick Batchelor and Frank Torres. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Obviously, a lot going on in the first few weeks of Governor Ron DeSantis's tenure as governor of the state of Florida. What are some standouts for you, Frank Torres?
Oh, you know, he seems to be going a little bit towards the middle than he typically has in the past. It was dropping the opposition to smokable marijuana, or seeming to lean that way. His budget was a lot more friendlier to causes, which, you know, in the past under Rick Scott necessarily haven't been. And just his general demeanor, he seems to be coming to the table, you know, ready to work. And in this environment, especially up in Washington these days, that's unfortunately very unusual.
Speaking of Washington, we are hearing from now Senator Rick Scott that Washington doesn't work. He was quite vocal about that during the shutdown. Just a bit of an aside, I guess, but do you get the sense that Rick Scott is bringing something new to Washington, D.C., his sort of style of leadership?
Well, you know, Rick Scott, I think, is going to continue to do what has worked for him in the past. He has always been he's always positioned himself as an outsider against a dysfunctional government, whether that be in Tallahassee or Washington, D.C. It just so happens that when he's actually saying it this time, the government is shut down and it is dysfunctional. But like Rick Scott, I think like Ron DeSantis, Rick Scott has come up there with a more open mind than we're accustomed to seeing him. And he also seems ready to bargain on some issues as well.
Mm-hmm. What stands out for you from this first few weeks of Governor DeSantis's tenure, Dick Batchelor?
First of all, I think what DeSantis is doing, keep in mind, he got elected, you know, beat the heir apparent, Adam Putnam, and won in the primary, won in the general with the Trump support. What I see him doing now is kind of redefining who he is, or defining for himself who he is. Because I think, you know, if you're 40 years old, if I serve two terms, I'm 48, I'm Harvard pedigree. I've got all those credentials, but now I need to decide who I am. I want to define who I am. So maybe when I'm 48, maybe I'm presidential timber, just like Rick Scott thinks he will be in 4 years, right? Or in 4 or 8 years. So if you look at him on the environmental record, wow. He basically asked for the resignation of everybody on the South Florida Water Management District. Bam.
Didn't get it, though.
But he will get it. There's a way to get it done. He'll get it done. This thing called the legislature. You can set term limits on them and have them gone. But also, another thing he's done is he came out of the box, even on Martin Luther King weekend, and gave a speech at Winter Park and made some overtures. He actually appointed a very nice young African-American from Pine Hills, Florida, to be the head of Enterprise Florida, Florida's Department of Commerce. He's made those appointments. So he's making overtures that, frankly, I'm very surprised by, but pleasantly surprised by. But I think the bottom line, he's going to try to define who he is and not be defined anymore as just a Trumpet.
Who do you think his base is, though? I mean, does he still have that core of support from the likes of the folks who got him elected?
The answer is yes, I think he does still have that. But I think also he's broadened that base because he kept winning again with the Trump supporters, even in the primary and in the general. He kept going to the right in the general, which is unheard of, but he won. But now I think he's going to broaden his base. He's got to reach out to that Adam Putnam constituency that was very, very strong, too, and pick off those people, too. So I think he's broadened his base. And you've got Democrats saying, hey, I'm surprised, but I'm pleasantly surprised at the things he's done. I think one more thing he can do here politically is the chairman of our water management district, St. John's Water Management District, Mikos, has all kind of recorded, publicly established conflicts of interest. What they should do is remove him as chairman of Water Management District, St. John's, and appoint a Republican who's very strong on the environment.
Speaking of people being removed and reappointed and shaking things up, what about the supervisors of elections? Because he obviously made some moves in Broward County and Palm Beach County to have them removed from office. But those were not the only counties where there were irregularities in the most recent election. So is there something going on here which he needs to pay a little more attention to?
Well, I think that he's been attacked mildly, though, I would say, are you removing only Democrats, supervisors of elections, right? And not Republicans. So, but those are the most highly visible, particularly Broward and particularly Palm Beach County. So I think he did it for political reasons, and going after the sheriff of Broward County too. You know, so I I think those are the most highly visible ones, but I don't really see kind of him removing Democrats, specifically Democrats. I don't see that. I think he just picked the ones that were highly visible and it just intuitively and politically said, mm-hmm. those are my targets.
Frank Torres, one thing, there's been so much news breaking from this administration in the last couple of weeks, but one thing we should talk about is Common Core.
Right.
Yeah. Ron DeSantis coming in saying, look, it's time for this to go. Just unpack that for us for a moment.
Well, that is a lot to unpack. We've been talking about Common Core for years now, and it's another one of those issues that has opponents and allies on both sides. I mean, this was a Jeb Bush thing a couple years back, and there have been people that have advocated and opposed it on both sides. I think Ron DeSantis is trying to be more pragmatic with educational solutions, and if there is really space for progress to be made that could really appeal to everyone in this state that turns more and more purple every day, it's definitely education. And we saw that as well in the budget. But this Common Core has always been so controversial, and the positioning of some of these tests, the opinions of the teachers, there are a lot of people that think it's okay. There are a lot of people that straight out don't like it. But what I'm hearing is an enthusiastic following for Common Core that I've never been able to, really, really put a nail on. So we're seeing Governor DeSantis sort of try to make some progress or find a system that appeals to everyone involved in the process.
I wonder, though, it takes so long to get these kind of new educational systems up and running. I mean, it seems like Common Core, they're constantly tinkering with it. They'll have to come up with something new.
Yeah, they're going to have to come up with something new. It's going to be Richard Corcoran, former Speaker of the House, that's going to have to do it. And a lot of people were looking at him. Richard Corcoran has a plenty long government background. They're wondering if he was really the guy to overhaul these things. So we're going to see what he can do. And, of course, hopefully he brings in parties or members of all the parties involved throughout the entire process and finds a good consensus for a system that everybody can sort of really rally behind.
What are your thoughts, Dick Batch? I mean, the fact that Common Core goes all the way back to Jeb Bush.
Actually, it goes back to his brother, too. That came in during the Bush 43 administration. That's where Common Core came from. And, look, I think it's semantics to a degree. Common Core is really red meat because you've got an element out there that's really opposed to Common Core, and some can't even define what that is. But I think if you look at what are the elements of Common Core, do you want standards? Yes. Do you want a test? Yes. Do you want a test to the test? No. Do you want to, do you want to engage the teacher so they can be professional and reward them financially? Mm-hmm. But I think so. I think you set the Common Core buzzword aside and then basically say, if you're going to do education reform yet again, what are the elements that have to be included? Obviously, quality education, quality teachers, slow down the turnover in the first year, particularly reward those teachers, let them teach in the classroom, not to the test, but to the subject. So that conversation we had, I think Corcoran is former speaker, as Frank pointed out, and now the commissioner of education. Keep in mind, he's the one that's on the front end of leading the charge for more private charter schools. Mm-hmm. So when you look at the budget that the governor is proposing, which by the way is an increase over last year for the K-12, are they going to take more money for private charter schools? So I think Common Core / education reform / private charter schools are all in the mix. You can't separate them out. So it's going to be a tough issue this session.
Mm-hmm. You listen to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty talking to political commentators Dick Batchelor and Frank Torres. Thinking about the budget, there's more money in it this year. Mm-hmm. Some thoughts on how he's going to pay for it?
Well, first of all, it's about $2 billion more than there was last year's budget. But fortunately, the revenue estimating conference, because the economy is predicting about $800 million in new money. So there's new monies there to advantage of the governor. So he could present it. Now, in the K-12 education, keep in mind that last legislative session, the per student increase was only, I think, 57 cents per student. Mm-hmm. So any increase would be attractive. So there is an increase in there. And he's got also an increase in money for environmental protection and other programs, even some, but limited in human services. Mm-hmm. But he has the luxury of having a good economy and a good tax base and tax collections to build an increased budget on. By the way, one thing that was, I applaud the governor again and make him very nervous. We've been talking about sweeping the Sadowski funds. Those are the affordable housing funds.
Sure.
In his budget, he doesn't sweep any of the $430 million out of affordable housing. So if he can hold that position and push back the Republicans from and not raiding those funds, that will go a long way to address the affordable housing crisis in Florida. In fact, had they spent all the money since 1992 on affordable housing that was intended for, there would be 230,000 more people housed today than would have been otherwise.
I know affordable housing is kind of in your wheelhouse, Dick Batchelor. Do you want to see more, though? I mean, are you hoping for something more in this budget to address that? I mean, particularly here in Central Florida, there is a housing crisis.
There's a housing crisis in Central Florida, but, I mean, and a lot of what we talk about trying to do is really like what I call moving the parsley on the plate. We don't have the steak. We just got the parsley left. So if they do not adequately fund the Sadowski funds, Affordable Housing Trust, we could just mess around with it, but we're not going to address it. So if, and the governor, I applaud him again to say, we'll keep the $430 million in the Sadowski funds. Don't sweep it. If he can convince his Republican colleagues not to take it, leave his budget alone, that's $430 million. That's a big chunk of money to go for affordable housing.
Mm-hmm. Frank Torres, what do you think is missing from this budget? What were you kind of expecting but haven't seen yet?
Well, you know, that's one thing. And this, and one thing to keep in mind is that this budget is essentially a suggestion.
Sure.
I mean, this thing's going to go before the legislature, and they're going to examine it. They're going to pick it apart. They're going to go backwards and forwards. Right now, it seems pretty comprehensive and pretty involving. I think one thing here in Central Florida, especially with some of the Democratic members of the delegation, they're going to point to the arts and some other aspects of education that haven't been addressed that might be picked up in maybe the educational part of the budget. And there's going to be other things that pop up along the way. But I can't hammer home how important the affordable housing issue is, especially here in the Tri-County area. Local leaders have identified it. In some parts of Orange and Osceola County, you have two families living in one-family homes.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to see how sustainable or how committed the legislature is to making sure that that gets the attention it needs. And there's going to be other issues that are going to pop up along the way.
Yeah.
Elections, making sure that money for the elections are to make sure those are ran better down the road are going to be there.
But
the environment is along those lines.
In Central Florida, at least, there haven't been to date significant issues with how elections are run, right?
No, there haven't. All the problems have been down south.
Yeah.
So what's it called? We're going to see what thing pops up along the way with as far as the budget goes.
No dangling chads in Orange County, as far as we know.
Two
quick areas, I think, where the governor could really make, and I think the issue will come back up in a big way, two issues. One is going to be the opioid crisis.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be a big issue. And how much money can you put in the budget to try to reduce the number of overdoses and deaths? So I think that funding and slash mental health funding, I'm going to put it, alcohol, drug abuse, mental health funding in the same bucket, because I think we're still 50 out of 50 states when it comes to mental health funding, particularly amongst children. So I think when we had that conversation around opioid addiction, drug abuse, alcohol, that kind of thing, I think that that pot of money could be one that would be singled out. And then to Frank's point, so you say, okay, I need money for opioid overdoses, deaths.
Mm-hmm.
I need money for children's mental health counseling, and I need money for arts.
Yeah.
That's where they look at it, and they say it's tough. I agree with Frank. Not that art shouldn't be funded, but I agree politically it's going to be very difficult.
And a quick callback, because it's too important to let up, that mental health funding or attacking the mental health problem is sort of a gun safety or a gun control issue for both parties.
Right.
There aren't very many times or very many avenues where the two parties meet, but addressing mental health is definitely on that, common
street. Although I think some people will say it's a bit of a red herring in some ways.
Well, I listen to the police data, and, there are a lot of calls, or if you ask a lot of law enforcement professionals, they'll want to know when they're responding to a call if this person has had mental health problems in the past, mm-hmm. and if there's a weapon in the home. So I think it's definitely an avenue, according to the data, that definitely needs attention.
One more thing I think we should talk about briefly, let me ask you two about. Over the weekend, former Secretary of State Mike Hotell breaking a silence on the blackface controversy, photographs that surfaced of him from a party 14 years ago. a statement there on Facebook. Did you read that, Dick Batchelor?
I read the article in the paper about the Facebook post. Yeah.
Thoughts on that?
Look, what he did, and he was an adult at the time, doing a blackface as a Katrina survivor in the face of 1,600 and some people dying in Katrina just within 2 months after that, is unforgivable from a public position. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to tie that into the Democratic governor of Virginia needs to resign. The bottom line is the governor of Virginia Northam was 25 years old when he did it. He was a med student. He knew what he was doing. Now, he knew when the picture came out, either he was the blackface minstrel or he was the Klansman. And the fact is he can apologize for his behavior, one, but the fact is he's no longer is entitled to be an elected official. He's no longer entitled to be the governor. That's the price he's going to have to pay because his constituents, who are African-American, look at a black face in a Klansman outfit, two students. That's what resonates with them. You know, it's a horrific part of their history. So the fact is, yes, you can apologize for it, which by the way, means you need to step down and say, I'm not entitled to represent a diverse constituency in Virginia or the state of Florida or any place else if you've done that.
Frank Torres, back to former Secretary of State Mike Hotel. What's next for him, do you think?
Well, you can't defend the act, but the thing here is that Mike Hotel served as supervisor of elections for Seminole County well for all that time.
Very well.
And that's what made this story so surprising and true. It's a case study on how to handle these mistakes. The act itself is indefendable, but Hotel handled it with as honorably as you could under the circumstances. And you've got a governor of Virginia who's turning back calls from both basically the entire country to step down. Mm-hmm. But
yeah, I read one comment on Twitter. He's resigning. He just doesn't know it yet.
And I wouldn't doubt that.
Yeah.
But I mean, as far as you look at his service to Seminole County and the popular opinion or public opinion of him in Seminole County, it's still going to be favorable.
Yeah.
We'll have to see what happens. It's just two very different situations, and a right way to handle it and a wrong way to handle it.
And it put the governor in a very awkward position, too. Keep in mind, during the campaign, it was a lot of race-tinged debate with Gillum.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Sanders family finally wins, appoints the head of Enterprise Florida, an African-American, as I mentioned. The irony was he appointed an African-American to replace Mike Hotel in Seminole County. And all of a sudden, so he's on a roll, kind of. He's reaching out and making overtures, right, on the race issue. And then all of a sudden, his Secretary of State's in blackface. So it's really the poor governor's like, look, I just can't escape this whole issue. So politically, Mike Hotel did the right thing. He resigned immediately, which was the right thing to do, and then apologized belatedly, but apologized for it.
Well, Dick Batchelor, former state representative and Democratic political analyst, thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you.
Also joined by Frank Torres, Republican political analyst. Frank, thank you as well.
Thank you so much.
Still to come on Intersection, esports goes to college. Intersection's back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Competitive video gaming is on the rise. Esports is reaching mainstream success, broadcasting championships for games like Overwatch on ESPN, along with physical sports leagues like the NFL and NBA hosting tournaments of the virtual versions of games like Madden and NBA 2K. The competitive esports bug is making its way to college, too. Teams of students are joining collegiate leagues and developing rivals just like in traditional sports like football and basketball. At the University of Central Florida, one of those teams is prepping for its first matchup in a collegiate tournament of the game, Rainbow Six Siege. It's a first-person shooter that pits teams of five in a tactical virtual matchup to disarm a digital bomb. 90.7's Brendan Byrne spoke with teammates Daniel Vinokurov and Luke McKinley, along with UCF Gaming Knights esports director Kevin Kuroga, ahead of the match about the growing competitive scene and the future of esports in colleges.
So, big game on Friday. First of all, give us a sense of what game you guys are playing. What is it?
So the game is called Rainbow Six Siege. It's kind of like Counter-Strike, Global Offensive, if you've ever heard of it. But it's a bit more tactical, where there's a lot of layers to the game. There's a vertical play, so there's maybe three floors, and you have operators with special abilities that are able to help you get into the A or B bomb site, which you either defuse. So you have half the game where you're attacking and trying to defuse the bombs, and then you have the other half of the game where you're defending and trying to disarm the bomb, or you're trying to stop them from disarming the bomb. Mm-hmm. And both defensive and attacking operators have different abilities to help them throughout the round.
And this is, you're playing from the first person perspective, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about like the pace of the game. It's a very tight, close quartered game. I had a chance to play it over the weekend. It's kind of chaotic, isn't it?
It does get extremely chaotic. It's 3-minute rounds, and those last 30 seconds, it's a living hell.
Mm-hmm.
Like everything's flying at you, and the pressure starts to set in. So it gets really chaotic,
mm-hmm.
and especially when you're in like a 1v1 or a 1vx situation.
Mm-hmm.
It's just adrenaline starts flowing.
And this is you would be on your own in the team against a few other people that are trying to kill you, right?
Yeah.
Basically. Okay. Well, Daniel, how did you get involved in playing this game and then playing it competitively?
Well, I played Counter-Strike like originally when it came out on not 1.6, but I played Counter-Strike Source, and my cousin got me into the game, and I sort of liked the tactical aspect of it, of you having to play against other people and try to outskill them or outgun them. And so I found Siege after I played CSGO a bit. Didn't really pick it up competitively, but I played soccer for like 14 years, so I always liked the competitive aspect of any game. And my friend, actually, Zachary Lombardo, he plays for Dallas Fuel on the Overwatch League. He went pro in Overwatch, so he sort of got me into like playing competitively in other games.
And Overwatch is another competitive esports game.
Yeah, right? It's another competitive esports game.
Massive.
It's way bigger than Siege right now, but Siege is on its way as well to becoming bigger and bigger. But he got me into playing competitively, and I've enjoyed it ever since.
Mm-hmm. And what about you, Luke? What got you into it?
So I've been playing video games on the computer since 2014. One of the first games that I started playing was Counter-Strike Global Offensive.
Mm-hmm.
I actually played for the UCF CSGO team for about 2.5 years. And then as of April of last year, I started to play Rainbow Six Siege full-time. And back in August, I actually founded the Rainbow Six Siege group at UCF, mm-hmm. and I made the UCF A team.
Luke, when you say play it full time, how many hours a week goes into playing the game?
Are
you playing 40 hours a week?
Basically.
Probably.
Yeah, probably.
There would be a lot of overtime. It's more like 80 plus hours a week.
Wow.
Yeah.
And how do you balance that? Because you both are students, right? So this is kind of, you go to class and then you practice for...
I know no one else can see it, but my eyes are bloodshot red. I was playing all last night.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
3 a.m, right?
Yep.
I don't play as much as him, but like... So I balance my workload, but still I see him playing literally the entire night just to go to work in the morning or school.
Yeah.
Kevin, I want to bring you in on the conversation because you are the director at UCF's Gaming Nights, which is an esports club. How many folks are in this group, and what kind of games do they play?
We probably have like over, I want to say like 100 members or so.
Okay.
We have nine different teams for different games. There's up to MOBAs, to Battle Royales, to FPS games like Rainbow Six Siege.
Okay, you got to walk us back on that. Start with MOBA. What is a MOBA?
You're fine. A MOBA is like League of Legends or like Dota 2.
Okay, so this is kind of like a top-down, you control a character on a map.
You got it. There are different abilities, ultimates. Then you have like FPS, which is like first-person shooter, like CSGO, Overwatch, which is kind of a mix of MOBA as well,
mm-hmm.
and Rainbow Six Siege.
Okay.
And then Battle Royale would be like Fortnite or PUBG.
Okay. What's the draw? Why do folks want to come to the club and, you know, play this game with students rather than just, you know, clicking on a lobby and going and playing with some strangers online?
Well, there's more passion, right? Because you're playing for your university, right? Because mm-hmm. suddenly you form a team with high-level players, which is sometimes difficult to find. And then you're all part of, you know, this club on campus that you're playing for university. You have the name, like UCF, and the leaderboards for the collegiate league. Every win you get, it says, like, oh, UCF so-and-so won the game, and it feels good, right? Mm-hmm. So people come together and start trying to play and play for the university. It's really nice, actually.
Have you seen an increase in memberships recently? Like, I know, as you guys mentioned earlier, Overwatch, just, you know, competitive Overwatch was crazy. Like, I found myself watching the finals, you know? Like, yeah, I never would have thought that I would be watching esports. And it was, like, really intense, and it was in on it. It was fantastic. I mean, have you seen this kind of this growth in folks playing these esports games and joining clubs like yours?
Oh, of course. It's been exploding for years, but I feel like 2018 was such a big year for esports, and 2019 is just going to grow bigger and bigger. I mean, you have games like Fortnite who are going to have over $100 million of tournament prizing for the year of 2019 and a little bit of 2018. Obviously, Fortnite, yeah, esports about it is a little shaky, but that still draws in so many people to play other games, too.
Mm-hmm.
And especially for our club, I mean, we've had members join that we had never even heard about that play all these games at a high level, and now they're on our esports teams. It's like, oh, well, this is great. Like, where are more of you? You know, we're trying to find everyone that can play and join our teams and just join the club in general.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to that, actually, like, so for reference, we had three teams for Rainbow Six Siege, but it was mostly, like, two that were actually playing, whereas this tryouts that we did in January, we actually had enough people interested to where we created five teams now. So we went from 2.5-ish to 5 in probably around like 4 months, just because of we put out a couple of advertisements about it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's a common thing with every team. He's right. League of Legends has three different teams. When we do tryouts in fall, we'll have around the same amount, 6, 5, 7 teams, who knows. Same with Overwatch. There's five different teams that we have.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, you know, only the A1 compete in the higher level, but we still recognize every student and every mm-hmm. team.
Daniel and Luke, you've got a big game coming up. How do you prepare for something like this? I assume there's some practice, but walk us through. Is it like soccer practice? Like, how do you get to play?
100%. If not, you probably sweat more. You get, like... I mean, it's not only, like, you know, mentally challenging, but it's physically tolling as well. When you're in, like, when you are in a 1v1 situation, again, when you're by yourself, you get your adrenaline pumping, and it's, like, a constant for, like, an hour and a half battle of just your adrenaline's pumping. You're trying to win. You're trying to play and trying to be the better player. And it gets you amped up. And we scrimmaging or practicing against other college teams around the U.S. Like, we've done, like, two mm-hmm. scrimmages this week. We plan on doing more to practice for our game. Mm-hmm. But, you know, for that, last night was, like, 3 hours of scrimmages. So we do that maybe, like, once every other day. You know, mm-hmm. we're putting in the time, and it's just challenging as well just to keep up with it.
Now, you said you were playing with other colleges. How competitive is it with other colleges? Are there rivals yet? Has it been established long enough yet?
Yeah. I think it's safe to say that UCF's Rainbow Six Siege rival is probably Penn State.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And why is that? Do we know?
Yes. Scheduling beef happened last semester, and we ended up beating him in the national championship, but we definitely made a rival.
Okay.
After that.
Yeah, so, like, they were trying to get a free win off of us, pretty much, because mm-hmm. we were in two leagues at the time,
mm-hmm.
and we were in playoffs for both. So they tried to get a free win off of us for the finals in one league while we were trying to get into the finals for the other.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And so because of that, they sort of became our rivals.
Okay. Sounds like a old UCF football, right?
Yep.
Trying to get a free exactly. win off of us, yeah. huh?
Exactly.
Kevin, talk about how this fits into the whole culture of athletics. This is something that's new, it's booming, and there are some organizations that are looking at esports on campus as an opportunity to kind of make some money, right?
Oh, of course. And there's huge money in esports. I mean, think about it. If you have a university with successful esports teams, you have high school players, you have high school people who play these video games, they want to go to university. You know, they want to play for your team. They want to get that scholarship or whatever. We have people hitting us up from high school saying, hey, do you have scholarships for this? Hey, do you guys have an arena? And I look at their Twitter profile, and they're all 13, 14, 15. And it's crazy to me to mm-hmm. think that they're even thinking about colleges that far from beyond, right? I had thought about college when I was a senior in high school, to be honest with you. So these esports teams and universities are exploding because of this. There's a lot of money involved, lots of sponsorships coming in, too, for multiple companies, for multiple teams. And it's something that universities can't really miss out on.
Mm-hmm. Are there any universities that offer scholarships for esports?
Oh, tons.
Really?
Probably, I'm assuming, like over 100, right?
Yeah, UC Irvine.
Yeah, all the California schools.
I know Rutgers gives you a scholarship as well.
RMU. Yeah.
Really?
RIT. Yeah. There's a bunch of universities. It's crazy.
I'm so jealous.
That gets me to ask the question, Kevin. Is this going into the realm of kind of being controlled by maybe a national organization? I'm thinking the NCAA coming in and taking over esports. Do you see that that's where this is going with all this money and all of this kind of coordination that needs to happen? Is that the next step?
Of course. It's definitely going to be the next step. I don't know if it's going to be tomorrow or in the next 5-10 years, but eventually it's going to come in. You know, a big organization like NCAA will definitely control everything. They're going to set up divisions just like it is now, and conferences and all that stuff, all these like playoff tournaments. Hopefully it comes soon because I want to see it, right? Mm-hmm. But yeah, no, that's definitely going to happen one way or another.
I've heard from some critics of the NCAA model that they don't want them sticking their noses in esports. Luke, Daniel, would you agree? Would you want to kind of play under the same kind of conditions that athletes have to play under?
Personally, yes. And the only reason why, or one of the only reasons why, is because it's a step in the right direction. If it could be anyone else other than the NCAA, yes. But if that's all we have, then I am perfectly fine with that.
I mean, I have no problems with it. The only reason I could think of is just financially. Sure, right now I love playing it. But if the NCAA comes in, they're like, we'll give you scholarship to play under these conditions, I think I could look over the conditions, because I know there's a lot of critics on the NCAA saying that, you know, they're not good for college sports. But I think just because esports where it is right now, if the NCAA were to take over and have some certain, you know, restrictions on what we could do, I think I'd be fine with it, just because it would jump us in like the next year to probably getting the viewership of regular sports.
Mm-hmm. One thing they didn't mention was the sponsor stuff, right? These guys are individual players. They have their own streams. They have their own brand. If they're part of the NCAA, they suddenly can't receive money. They can't have sponsors. They can't do anything, any of that stuff, because they're NCAA. They're part of a university now. And that's a big thing that they could be missing out on. I mean, Luke streams every day, gets 10-plus viewers average, and that's a income for him, right? And then potentially he can build off from that, play in a pro team or get sponsorships for himself. And if they were part of the NCAA, they want to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm. But the other argument is, if you are a part of the NCAA, you've got a national stage, and then you're propelled. And then so once you finish school, you can do that too. But it's interesting, you know, the whole economics of esports is great. Like, there are some out there that this is their full-time job, right, is playing these games. Talk a little bit about, you know, where you guys see your future.
For me, at least, 2019, I feel as though it's going to be a really big year for me.
Okay.
Especially with Rainbow Six Siege. They have the one of the biggest tournaments ever in Siege coming up in February, called Rainbow Six Siege Invitational. It's in Montreal. A lot of the big YouTubers and Twitch streamers are going to be there. A lot of the developers of the game are going to be there. I myself am going to be there. So a lot of opportunities to not only see these professional players play, but also mainly to network with all these people and just get your name out there in the community. And once you reach a certain level in the community, it just seems to take off. So I don't know if I'm right there. I'm hoping I am. But I know that by the end of 2019, I will definitely be there.
So we should be writing your name down right now, is what you're saying, and remembering.
Give me a signature.
Yeah, I'll sign that notepad after.
Daniel, do you see this as being a profession or a career after college?
For me, personally, I don't know about that one, just because I was raised in a household where, you know, go to college, get a job.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely risky profession, because you never know when it's going to end. So I could definitely possibly see, if, you know, something happens where I'm offered a place to play, or if I'm offered a way to stream or make content online on the game, I could see it possibly being a secondary source of outcome, but not really a primary one for me.
Mm-hmm. And Kevin, I'll give you the final thought here. if folks want to watch this Friday or they want to get into observing esports, what's the best way to do it, and how should they approach kind of watching one of these matches?
They should go to Twitch and go to Collegiate R6. That's actually the Twitch link, and watch, and they'll have the spectator. In my opinion, the best way to do it is maybe to research the game a little bit, either play it or watch some videos just to see what's going on. The general consensus is obvious. There's five people on a team versus another five. Either kill each other or defuse the bomb. Depends on which side you're on. And honestly, just enjoy, right? Mm-hmm. It's just like watching Overwatch League, the finals, like you said. You might not know what's going on, but you certainly know which team is winning, right? You see the scoreboard. You see people cheering. You see the casters listening to them, listening to what they're saying. You know, you'll understand the whole point of it.
Well, Kevin Quiroga is the esports director at UCF's Gaming Nights. Kevin, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And also Daniel Vinokurov and Luke McKinley, who are on the Rainbow Six Siege team that will be playing this Friday. Daniel, Luke, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks for having us.
And you can watch UCF's Rainbow Six Siege team compete this Friday starting at 9 p.m. on the streaming site Twitch. Up next, novelist Anna Levi tells the stories of underrepresented voices like orphans, and her writing reflects the spoken language of Trinidadian Creole.
In primary school, we used to have writing competitions, and I didn't care about writing standard English. I broke all the rules, and nobody complained.
A conversation with Anna Levi when Intersection returns. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Anna Levi is a novelist with roots in Trinidad and Grenada. Her debut novel, Medina Girl, tells the story of Maria as she struggles to avoid a life of domestic servitude. Levi writes about what she calls Trinidad's underworld culture, and her writing evokes the spoken language of Trinidadian Creole. She joined Intersection to read an excerpt of her novel, Medina Girl.
Mother went into the bathroom and started the crying game. Mary and Sophia sucked their thumbs with tuck-tuck echoes and lay on the bed staring at Mother's grief. She complained to herself bitterly while packing three vests, two short pants, two jerseys, two underpants, a toothbrush, Pablo's immunization card and a testament in a black garbage bag. I was happy for Pablo because my chances of leaving were forthcoming. I'm leaving forever, Pablo whispered in my ear, and I giggled, trying to form a mental image of him in the next 10 years. I wondered if he'd learn how to become a businessman and open a mini-mart like Mrs. Punani, or become an alcoholic like Mutilal, or maybe Mrs. Punani's dal might stimulate Pablo's brain to read books and become one of the best professors in Trinidad.
And that's Anna Levi reading from her debut novel, Medina Girl.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And that was a part of your first novel, Medina Girl. Who's the narrator in the story?
The narrator is a young girl who is growing up in a village with a poor family, and she, you know, grows in the book from the age of 11 straight on to 15 when she left home.
Mm-hmm. And she is seeing her little brother who's been essentially sold to help this other lady run her store.
Yeah, she's talking about her experience as a child. Mm-hmm. And her brother, her stepbrother, they have different fathers and the same mother, and he is sold into child labor.
What is it that sort of makes you want to write about these things?
Well, I grew up in a village very much like this in Trinidad. You don't really see it a lot now in Trinidad. But in the world, I try to represent the invisible voices, children who cannot speak, children who are traumatized by events in their lives. When they get older, they reflect on their lives and they're afraid to talk about it, but they have been deeply traumatized and affected by it. So I grew up with orphans, children in a village, runaway children, and I've been, you know, speaking to children all my life and listening to their stories, and I felt the need or the responsibility to represent them.
And what's the response been in Trinidad and beyond?
Well, a lot of people in my village and my neighbourhood, they read it and they validate it. This is what has happened to... They can relate to it because they know this has happened to someone in their family or themselves. Mm-hmm. And I get a good response from the people because I write their language, the Trinidadian English Creole. I use their language to represent them.
How How many different languages are part of that? Because it's not just English and it's not just Creole, right? There's other languages in there too.
Yeah, well, Trinidad is a very multi-ethnic, multi-religious society, and we are very diverse people. And so we have Indians who speak Trinidad English Creole, but have some of the Indian words. To, you know, we have Africans as well. We have Chinese. We have, you know, and most of them, they have kept some of their languages from their ancestors and some of the words that they, you know. So I have some of the words that they use, you know, and their English Creole.
In primary school, did your teachers encourage kids to write in Creole and other languages too, or was it strictly English?
In primary school, they used to have writing competitions, and I would write in my... I didn't care about writing standard English. I broke all the rules, so I guess, and nobody complained. So I wanted to write what I know.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, they're really encouraging to speak your language, because even the teachers, they don't speak standard English all the time. They speak Trinidadian English Creole and other languages. So, you know, we welcome all flavors.
So you had some encouraging teachers?
Yes.
In school?
Yeah.
Kind of encourage that writing bug?
Yes. I always wanted to. I was always writing and reading as a child. And, you know, I went to school with orphans and they had stories. So, and there were orphans living in my village, like, you know, a girl, she would tell me about her life and she would tell me little secrets, and it would stay in my mind. And I said to myself that one day I would write about it, and I just didn't know how to write about it, but it just came naturally.
Mm-hmm. And you've recently moved from Trinidad, right, to Grenada?
Yes.
Tell me about that. Why the move?
My mom was born in Grenada and left for Trinidad when she was 25. And she was an undocumented immigrant for many years. And I always, you know, knew that I was from another place, you know, when it comes to my mother, where she came from. I felt the otherness. So I wanted to explore the otherness of myself and where I came from through my mother.
And what have you found so far?
Well, Grenada is absolutely beautiful. You know, it's a beautiful place. The people are beautiful. The culture is beautiful. The food is beautiful. It's just a different kind of feeling. And it's, you know, it's a place for healing. It's a place for many beautiful things.
From your description of Trinidad sounds like a real melting pot of different cultures. Is it the same in Grenada too? Do you have the same kind of multi-ethnic society there?
Well, yeah, Grenada is actually, we have all kinds of people living there, immigrants that move there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's developing into be very multicultural, but it's not as multi-religious as Trinidad. In Grenada, I don't see any temples like in Trinidad. I see a lot of Baptists, spiritual Baptists, but I don't see a lot of different religion practicing.
Do you kind of see yourself as fitting into a tradition of Trinidadian writers, or are you really forging a new path?
Well, I don't feel that I am completely Trinidadian, completely, but I acknowledge that Trinidad made me who I am. They give me a lot culturally. But I see myself as an international writer representing, you know, all voices. So as a writer, I don't see myself as just a single, you know, I'm coming from Trinidad.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm coming from Trinidad, but I'm coming from elsewhere as well. I'm coming from all over because I am mixed. I have African in me. I have Indian, Portuguese, Indigenous. I have all those flavors in me. And I explored in Trinidad many other things. People from Syria, cultures from Syria, all kinds of different cultures. And I feel a part of it all.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, Trinidad is like the center of everything. They've given me everything, so I feel like I'm everything.
And your next book is due out pretty soon, right? Nowherians?
I'm finishing a book, Nowherians, and it's my MFA thesis. So I'm completing an MFA in creative writing at the University of the West Indies. Yeah, so I'm working on that book right now. But I think I have a story published online at the Florida Review from my current novel.
And give us a flavor, if you could, of what Nowherians is about.
Well, I look at underworld culture and I look at all kinds of different cultures in Trinidad. No Reverence is about abandoned children, children of sex-working mothers, children in foster care, and tracing their lives and following their lives from childhood into adulthood and showing the parts and the circumstances of their lives.
Now, you don't just write, you also help organize English as a second language classes for folks?
Yes. So because my mother was an immigrant to Trinidad, I was born into that world. I grew up in that world. So I've met a lot of immigrants coming to Trinidad. And yeah, so I'm part of that community. I'm part of the immigrant refugee community in Trinidad. And last year I organized with the University of the West Indies, help find refugees, mostly vulnerable women and children, to learn English as a second language so that they can find work and, you know, merge into the culture much easier to survive. Yeah.
Are you actually teaching classes yourself as well?
No, I used to do that when I used to live in Trinidad, part-time. So I might come across a few immigrants and or refugees who need and want to learn English as a second language, and I would offer my services, help them. And I used to do it, but now I'm in Grenada. It's it's difficult.
Where are these folks coming from, by and large?
Mostly Venezuela, Cuba, a few from Colombia, Bangladesh and Pakistan. Yeah.
So when they come to Trinidad, do they have any English at all? Or is it that they're learning English from scratch?
Most of them are learning English from scratch. But there are very few who may have learned English in university. A lot of them who have been to university and have degrees. Yeah, but basically they move on the instinct because they pick up the English Creole and they're learning, they're willing to learn. And it's, you know, it's some of them, it's difficult to pick up the language because of the standard English and the Trinidadian English Creole. But eventually they get it.
The passage you read from, and I guess you're writing in general, kind of combining these different languages, is it something that somebody who doesn't, you know any Creole or any of the other languages, is it easy to read for somebody who's not familiar with that?
Yeah, I guess some people would when you're reading it. So some of the words are spelled different, but some people can pick it up. So like instead of saying "de," you put "d e" as in "d."
Mm-hmm.
So I think some people when they're reading it could understand it, but when I am reading it to them, they may not pick up on it easily. I don't know how you felt.
It's very kind of lyrical sounding. It's like, I think it lends itself to being read out loud, actually. Is that the way you see it?
Yeah, well, I honestly, I don't like to read my work, which is bad for a writer, which maybe it's not bad. You know, I don't like to read my work. I like to write my work and send it out there and just hide.
So the book tour part of publishing a novel is not the most fun experience for you?
Yeah, I'm really, you know, maybe some anxiety. You know, all writers have their own, you know, emotional issues because of what they write. And, you know, it's just that I don't like to read my work.
Well, what do you hope people come away from, either from this book or your forthcoming novel? What do you want people to take away from it?
Well, I want people to understand the reality of what I write about and make a change on the lives of people. So you have immigrants coming in to Trinidad and this is the treatment of immigrants and, you know, change the way your approach and find a solution on how to deal with issues and not just ignore it or make people suffer or, you know, find the best solution and learn how to deal with it in the best possible ethical way.
Well, Anna Levi, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Anna Levi will hold a public reading at the University of Florida in Gainesville this Wednesday, and she'll present a writing workshop at the Chickasaw branch of the Orange County Public Library on Friday. Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Ashley Garrett. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we're on the NPR One app. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.